Welcome to The Man in Black, but Not Johnny Cash, featuring Father Andrew Welzig, Jacob Lee, and Steve McMeans. The Man in Black, but Not Johnny Cash, is part of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Welcome to The Man in Black, but Not Johnny Cash podcast. I'm Jacob Lee, and today we have Father Andrew joining us via Skype. How are you doing, Father Andrew?
Doing okay. Been fighting another cold virus, but I think I'm starting to get better.
And then coming in from Chicago via Skype, we have Hemat.
Hi.
And Mata is your last name. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mata.
And you are known as the Happy Atheist?
Friendly Atheist, I think. Yeah, mine.
Okay. He's the happy, friendly atheist. And live in studio with me, we have Callie Lee, my wife, and she has read your book, loves your book, and she and Father want to talk about the Why I Sold My Soul on eBay. How are we doing, Callie?
Oh, we're doing good. Thank you for coming on with us, Hemet. We started a little bit of a conversation after I picked up your book and mentioned it on the Generation Orthodox podcast here on the Icon New Media Network. And we talked back and forth just a little bit. And I thought it would be really cool if you could come on and just explain to our listeners what your book's about, a little bit about your background. And then we could talk about atheism and orthodoxy and do a little different show for sure. The Man in Black here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great. Tell us a little bit about what you come from as a religious background before you became an atheist.
Sure. Well, I was raised in a family that was Jain, and that's J-A-I-N. It's an Indian religion. That's what my parents both were. That's what they still are. And for those who don't know, that religion really focuses a lot on nonviolence. So pretty much any Jain you'll meet is going to be vegetarian, and I still am. So there's nothing wrong with that in my eyes. That's philosophical. The belief in nonviolence, that's always good. Where I kind of strayed from it is because when I was around 13 or 14, I started questioning a lot of our doctrine in terms of reincarnation, because Jains believe in that. And we believe in, you know, heaven and hell and just these supernatural entities. And I found that I just didn't have any reason to believe in them, or I didn't see why, you know, we believed in it. How come we believe in reincarnation, but no one else I know does, you know, things like that. And after a short period of questioning, I mean, we're talking the span of a couple months, I realized, wait a minute, I don't think I believe that, so I don't think I can call myself a Jain. And when I started doing some research, like, what do you call yourself if you don't believe in those things? Basically, the word that kept popping up was an atheist. And so at some point, I began just calling myself an atheist and learning more about it in the process, and it's just kind of stuck since then.
So you grew up in this Indian religion that I had to Wikipedia to learn, learn about.
That's fine. Wikipedia has a pretty good entry on Jainism.
Well, that's good. How did you come to decide to go to church?
Once I became an atheist, I was pretty closeted about it for the first few years. Only really close friends knew about it. But once I got to college, I really wanted to meet other atheists, other people who kind of thought the way I did, and I couldn't find any of them. None of my friends were, that's for sure. I met someone, we started a group together, and I met a few other atheists in the process. But the important thing is this girl that I started the group with said, you know, we should get affiliated with a national atheist organization. And I didn't even know there were any. But she said, you know, we're a college campus group. There is actually a national organization called the Secular Student Alliance that basically organizes college atheist groups, kind of like Campus Crusade for Christ, but for atheists. I learned about this national organization through them, through this girl, and we affiliated ourselves. And eventually I got on the board of the Secular Student Alliance. I'm now the chair of the Secular Student Alliance. And through that group, I kind of learned about other national atheist organizations and started working with a lot of the leaders of these groups. And basically, you know, in the past 5 or 6 years that I've been really actively involved with these groups, I realized that if you talk to the people running these groups or, you know, taking an active role in these groups, most of them do not come from atheist backgrounds. They're coming from Christian backgrounds or, you know, Jewish backgrounds. And, they, you know, if you ask them, what was church like for you? You know, they'll tell you some stories about their Christianity growing up, and you wonder if it's biased. You wonder if, you know, are they really telling me an objective opinion on these churches? And I realize, you know, I've never been to any of these churches myself firsthand because I wasn't raised in this religion. And I kind of want to know if church is really the way they say it is, or if it's something totally different. You know, maybe I'll hear something that I've totally missed in my years as an atheist. So I really wanted to go to church, and that's where this auction kind of came about.
So you put your soul or your time up on the block on eBay.
Right, I basically put up this eBay auction that said, send an atheist to his local church. The word soul, I should say. The word soul was nowhere in the auction.
But that is the word that has been jumped on by everybody from the Wall Street Journal. And
the Wall Street Journal ran a front page story on it. All papers followed, and they all started using this phrase that I was selling my soul on eBay. And so I had to spend a lot of time explaining, no, that's not what I did. There really is a serious thing that I did behind all this.
So what was the result of this wonderful eBay auction?
Well, the result was that, the funny thing was you had Christians bidding on eBay that I go to their particular church. Then you had atheists bidding that I don't go to church, and they kind of set each other off. And so the price kept jumping up. But at the end of the auction, a Christian pastor from Seattle, Washington, won the auction at $504, all of which was donated. But this Christian pastor, former pastor, won the auction and said, you know, I owed him 50, you know, Sundays worth of church. And he said, don't do that because I'm a former pastor and I don't want to do that. So we made a deal where I would go to around 10 churches of his choosing, all different churches in the Chicago area. And basically, I would write about my experiences on his website. His online ministry was called Off the Map. And I would write about my experiences on his site, and that's what we ended up doing.
So you visited 10 churches. What can you describe? I mean, I'm guessing these were Protestant churches, evangelical?
Actually, this type spanned the gamut. There were a lot of Protestant or non-denominational churches, but I did go to a couple mega churches. I went to a Baptist church. I went to an all-black church. I went to a house church inside of a pastor's living room. I'm trying to think which other types there were. But those were the bulk of them.
Okay. So you've never been to an Orthodox church?
Not that to my knowledge, no.
Yeah, I think you'd have noticed. it's a little bit different of an experience. But let's just talk a little bit. When you went to these churches, what was the thing that struck you the most?
You know, I think it was really some of the pastors were excellent speakers, where even though I disagreed with, you know, a lot of what they were saying, I found myself really compelled by what they were saying. It was really interesting to hear their stories, whereas some of these other churches were utterly Simpson-esque and boring, and I could see why people don't really like going to church. But that wasn't the case everywhere. I also found that a lot of pastors, were either, like I said, utterly boring. There were some who were kind of putting this front up that it's really us as Christians versus everyone else. And, you know, everyone else is wrong. They are going to hell. And they portrayed it as a very antagonistic thing. Like, if you're not with us, you're totally against us. And I didn't like that. They kind of made a lot of disparaging remarks about atheists, people like me, which was also disturbing. And, you know, there were a couple pastors that were using, they were citing stories. They were telling stories. But these stories were completely made up, or they were, you know, they weren't accurate at all. And I found myself questioning, you know, where are you getting this from? Because it's not true. And they wouldn't say that it's a made-up story. They would actually say, here's a true story. And yet, when you actually did a bit of research, you would find that that's not the case. And I wondered kind of, what's their own research process? Are they really that gullible? Things like that.
What kind of stories are you referring to?
You know, what's one story that I heard? One story was, I don't know if I'll get this totally right, but I think it was like Leonardo da Vinci was doing a painting. And this guy prefaced the story by saying this is a true story. and he painted the picture of Jesus, and he used a friend of his as the model for Jesus. And after he painted this drawing, you know, he needed to draw Judas as well. And this was years later, I guess, or something like that. But he ended up trying to find a model for Judas, and he found this vagrant, this guy who was like a robber, a criminal. And he used this guy as a model for Judas, and he found out later on that this was the same person who had just kind of fallen from grace, quote unquote.
Right.
And this is the story that I heard. And when I did a little bit of research on it, like, there were no credible sources actually saying this was a true story. In fact, I did find some sites that said this is an urban legend, and here's why it's an urban legend, things like that. And I just wondered, you know, it's fine if you want to say a story that is actually untrue and you want to use it as a metaphor for something. But
right.
This guy prefaced it by saying, here's a true story. And I'm sure he does that quite a bit, you know.
Hmm.
Just kind of made me wonder where he's coming from, and why should I, if I don't believe you when you say this, and I have reason not to believe you, what else are you saying that's a lie, you know?
It's a great question.
It really is. What were the things you really didn't like? I mean, that's one of the things you mentioned that didn't make any sense.
I didn't like when they were just very actively anti everyone who wasn't in their little club. Because it's one thing to have different beliefs from people, but I still believe that, you know, even atheists and Christians share a lot of the common goals together. And to kind of dismiss people who think differently than you, even for major, major issues, I think it's doing yourself a disservice. There's also the idea that besides just doing the antagonistic, there were a couple churches I went to that said, we're going to convince you why there is a God. And I was kind of intrigued by that, because I want to know what arguments are they going to use, because, I mean, when it comes down to it, it boils down to faith. I just don't have any reason to believe in it. But I wanted to know what evidence are they going to use to prove God. And frankly, they used things that any high school atheist could kind of argue against. They were using a lot of anecdotal evidence. You know, here was a person who was down in the dumps. They were very depressed, but they put their faith in God and things got better. Well, that's great, but it's not going to convince any atheist that there's a God out there. I mean, they're using kind of emotions to try to guide you, and we know better than to let emotions convince us of something, you know?
Yeah.
Those are the things that really stuck out to me, because they were just – they're very basic arguments that I think a lot of atheists could argue against. I also kind of got frustrated at things I know a lot of other Christians get frustrated about. Things like, you know, how come people are at church and looking at their watch every 5 minutes? You know, if you don't want to be there, don't go. Why are some churches getting all this money coming in and using it to improve, you know, their own church instead of putting it out into the community, into the public, where people could actually use that help? Some churches did it, but not a lot of them. You know, things like that really stuck out to me.
Two things you mentioned there just really kind of struck out to me. You talked about how we're all just still human beings, atheist, Christian, whatever. And it almost seems a different perspective from the big slew of books that have come out recently.
Yeah. I think what those new atheists, things like people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, their purpose in writing their books is to try to convince people why they shouldn't believe in God. And I'm not really set out just to do that. I'm more interested in thinking that, you know, I know Christians are going to be around for quite some time. I have – this sounds so cliche, but I have plenty of friends. Some of my closest friends are Christians. I'm not out to just convince you that, you know, your beliefs are wrong and I'm right, because that doesn't really get us anywhere. I'm more interested in seeing, you know, where we can get along, what things we agree on, and where we can go from there. And yes, in the process, there's plenty of room for healthy debate on this stuff. But, you know, so that's where I'm coming from. And so when I'm listening to this stuff, I'm not really trying to point out, you know, here's where your argument is flawed and things like that, which I think, you know, the Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins types would. I'm more interested in seeing what are you doing with religion now that you have it, things like that.
I think that that is something that we all need to think about is, you know, now that we have this faith and whatever it may be in, how is it shown? And, you know, to be a Bible quoter, you know, your faith is shown by your works. And I think that is one thing to kind of segue into differences of the Orthodox faith from some of these churches you may have visited. we believe that very strongly, that your faith isn't just something between you and Jesus and, you know, you read your Bible and you're good to go. It's something that we actively work out. And Father, if you could just kind of jump in here and give us a very quick overview into to what a Christian should look like in the Orthodox Church.
Well, that's a very difficult question, to be honest with you. But, I think before we look at the manifestation, the outworking of the faith within Orthodoxy, I think that it's important for Hemet to understand that really the Eastern Church is coming from such a radically different place. The worldview is very different than the rest of Christendom. And the way that that's worked out is very different because the starting point is different. The starting point, quite frankly, about God, theology proper, is different. The starting point about man or anthropology is different. And when you have a different starting point with regards to God and man, you're going to come to different conclusions. And the reality is, our conclusions are radically different in some ways than anything you've ever experienced in any of those Protestant churches, or even if you had visited a Roman Catholic church. So it's important to understand that, and I'm sure you do understand this, you sound like a very intelligent man, that you can't lump all of Christendom under the same umbrella.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and I think one of the nice things that came out of this whole project in terms of going to the churches, writing I Sold My Soul on eBay, and even now writing on my friendlyatheist.com website, is that I've kind of broadened my spectrum of what I thought Christianity was. I had this very stereotypical view of it beforehand, but I've kind of learned, it was surprising to me to see people who were so conservative in their ways. I didn't realize, it was so that was such a big part of Christianity. I also didn't know that there were so many Christians who were so against the way their Christianity was portrayed by that group.
Yes.
So I didn't realize, this is me kind of tongue-in-cheek joking, I didn't realize there were so many Christians who were Democrats,
Yes, yes.
Things like that. And that whole spectrum of Christianity kind of buttoned. And, the range of views is just amazing.
Right. Yeah. You talk about sharing core values. What are the core values that you would say are shared by atheists as well as Christians?
I think the idea that we can't ignore the world that we're living in. Atheists don't believe there's an afterlife, so we believe we have to make this world the best possible one that there is. And I think a lot of Christians would agree you can't ignore problems like global warming, things like that, because we have to protect this world that we're living in. You can't just assume you're going to go to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing is the belief that people should be treated equally, regardless of who they are, where they're coming from, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of basic issues like that.
Mm-hmm. Where do you, from your worldview, Hemet, where do you consider the notion even of values to come from?
I think we can assign values. There are evolutionary explanations that I wouldn't be the best expert to tell you about them. But I think some of the basic things, we have to live in society. We have to work together to survive as a species. We have to get along in some ways. So, if people are lying from each other, stealing from each other, you can't have a functioning society. You have to have some sort of order there. And so some of these things come about organically. But I don't think you need someone to tell you that, killing someone is a bad thing. You don't need someone to point that out. It's something that's just kind of obvious.
Mm-hmm. And when you say someone to tell you, who is it that's telling you that you shouldn't kill somebody?
I think a lot of people will say that, if God didn't write in the Bible that, thou shall not kill, then everyone would just be out killing everyone. And that's obviously not the case.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. I understand.
And I should point out, too, these are great questions and they deserve to be debated and talked about. One of the things I've tried to do in talking about this book and writing it is that I'm not trying to debate these issues, because there are people who are far better debaters than I am, who know the arguments a lot better than I do. One of the things I've tried to do is show Christians, here's where atheists are coming from, and here's what we do believe, instead of just what you know us for what we don't believe. Here's what we do believe, but here's what you, if you want to interact with us, here's some things you got to know about us, you know? Some stereotypes, things like that, just trying to point them out. And the nice part is that a lot of Christians, you know, I've spoken in churches about this. I've spoken at Christian colleges about this, and I think that's one of the things that to me is one of the most exciting things, that they're willing to hear what I have to say about atheism instead of just getting into a debate about, you know, where certain aspects of our beliefs come from, things like that.
Right. Yeah, that's very important, a dialogue like that. You know, to be honest with you, Hammond, I mean, you know, I think if one has a proper understanding of historic Christianity, they would be in complete agreement with St. Paul when he says that if Christ is not risen from the dead, then let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that one of the things that's often projected, unfortunately, in Christian circles, particularly in Western American Christian circles, is this really heavy-handed moralistic expression of Christianity that has nothing to do with Christianity. The reality is St. Paul is, from our point of view, spot on. In other words, if there was no resurrection, at least I think a thinking Christian would be much more inclined towards atheism or nihilism than trying to live some sort of, you know, quote-unquote moral life just to live a quote-unquote moral life. There's no reason to live a moral life. If you understand the Christian worldview, there's no reason to have values. That's why I asked you about the values. Or to – it just doesn't matter, because for us it's all about a transcendent reality. It isn't about some sort of mutual agreement that we're coming to as human beings, because we're never going to come to a mutual agreement. The history of mankind clearly demonstrates that. So, you know, for us, it's not about being good. It's about truth. It's about right. discovering truth.
I think one of the issues with that is a lot of people have you know, the reasons where we're coming to these truths from is basically what the basis of those arguments are between the new atheists and the Christian apologists, things like that.
Yeah.
And that's going to keep going. I don't think there's going to be any solution to that that every side agrees with anytime soon.
You're right.
So, yeah, what you're saying is absolutely important. And, you know, there are plenty of arguments to be made for why certain versions of truth or our methods of coming to them, things like that, are better than another type.
Sure.
But, yeah, the point is we still have to interact with each other. So what are people doing that, you know, doesn't let that happen? And I'd argue that, you know, going through some of these churches, they're really setting it up so that not only that these people have, you know, don't believe in our truth, but you shouldn't even interact with them. Or they're putting out stereotypes about people who don't believe in their version of the truth. And therefore, there is no dialogue even happening at all, not just yes. about, you know, theology or religion, just in general.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that really disturbed me, going to some of these churches.
Yes. Well, the fact of the matter is in most of those scenarios, so to speak, it's hard for me to even call them churches. The whole idea of dialogue is foreign to them because they're coming from – again, this very moralistic point of view, and it's easier for them to point fingers and make accusations and make outrageous claims than to actually enter into a dialogue with a living human being who may disagree with you, fundamentally disagree with you. It's funny to me because I don't understand why they feel so threatened. There's no threat to the worldview. The worldview is self-contained as a Christian. You know, atheism is not going to – I mean – The amount of atheists could grow and grow and grow, and they could outnumber us 100-1, but it still doesn't affect a historic Christian understanding of God and man and the cosmos and everything else. So the fear to me, well, like so many times with fear, it's irrational. And, you know, I'm enjoying listening to you. I mean, obviously you're an intelligent guy and you're thinking through things. as best as you can. And I don't know what the fear is. I think we should invite the dialogue, actually.
Mm-hmm. One of the most exciting things I think I was able to do during all this is that one church pastor said, this is when the Da Vinci Code movie came out, and he said he wanted to do a series of sermons about doubt and certain things about the Bible. And this is like a 4-week sermon that he was doing. And the last week he said he wanted to show his church that it's okay to have doubts about your beliefs. And as a church, you know, they should be able to confront those doubts and talk about them, think about them. And basically he invited me to speak with him on stage for 3 different sermons over the course of the weekend. And we just went back and forth. This was unscripted, though we had an idea of what the other was going to ask. But, you know, it was an unscripted conversation. Just let me ask you my biggest question about atheism. Let me, Hemant, ask the pastor about my biggest questions about Christianity. And just to show that, you know what, these are good conversations to have. They're important to have. And no, you're not going to like every answer or be happy with the other person's answer. But, you know, it's a chance to just show people, look, this is how you do it. And when you're done, you can still shake the other guy's hand and be done with it.
Absolutely.
And it was really good. I think it was fun for the audience. There were some people that actually came to church 3 times that weekend so they could see all these conversations because they were always different.
Yeah, of course. I think people are unfortunately of the opinion oftentimes that if you doubt your faith, whatever your faith is, that's a negative thing. But you pointed out something very important. I think in reality, questioning your faith is really healthy, at least potentially so.
I agree. And if you know what, if the church, and I'm sure you would agree with me on this, if the church is really confident in what they believe, they should welcome those types of questions. And I found that, you know, a lot of places I went to, they don't encourage those types of questions. It's not even talking about doubt. But if you have questions about what the pastor said that afternoon, there's no forum where anyone can really question what the pastor was saying or, you know, how did they know this? Things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the fears from the types of churches that you went to arise from the fact that, again, from a historical Christian point of view, they really don't have any foundation whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
They're operating really in isolation from a 2,000-year tradition, mm-hmm. and when you do that, you know you're going to find yourself on the precipice all the time, and I think that the way that will affect the way that you speak about your faith will be reflected in exactly this kind of fear context, because they really don't know what they're talking about historically. They're making claims, you know, beyond Leonardo and that vagrant story. When it comes to even their understanding of the scriptures, they're on a very, very shaky foundation because of the way that they're approaching the scriptures. Christians historically have never approached the scriptures. So, go ahead.
No, sorry. Let me give you the reason I went to the churches I did, at least when writing the book. Mm-hmm. The reason I went to the churches I did, which were predominantly non-denominational churches, Protestant churches, the biggest reason for it was simply a marketing point of view that those are the people that tend to buy these types of books.
Absolutely.
So that's why I focused on those, not because it was going to give me the broadest view of Christianity necessarily. And I know if I had gone to different, you know, denominational churches, or if I went to Orthodox churches, I would have gotten a very different view of Christianity than just kind of the myopic view, if that's the right word, that I was in. Yeah. But that's the reason I went to the churches I did.
Sure.
Well, and I think just solely, you know, on the book's merit, you know, if you are a non-denominational pastor and you're looking to grow your church and invite people who do not believe or believe other things, you offer some very good suggestions on how to make your church more palatable for an atheist. That's not really as orthodox. You know, we're not going to change our services because they haven't changed in, you know, 1600 years. I think that there still is, you know, people in our audience that are either considering orthodoxy or are of other Christian faiths, that your book points out a lot of things, like we've been talking about, that really were interesting about your church experience. And because you had an outsider's perspective, you noticed when people were checking their watches and ready to go. And you noticed when a pastor would make a claim like that, that was really an urban legend. Go ahead. I just think that that as Orthodox, you know, one of the reasons we're here is to bring the Orthodox faith into dialogue with the rest of society, the media, and the general population, because traditionally we've been a very small percentage of Christianity in America. And, you know, clearly we're so small that, you know, we're not the target market for very many books. But in the same sentence, that to bring into dialogue conversations with atheists or with people of other faiths. And I'm very thankful that you were able to come on with us. There's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about just briefly. You mentioned at the end that people kept asking you, what would it take to convert you? Is your answer still the same in the book? Or what would it take?
Yeah, my answer in the book was that I would probably need to witness firsthand a miracle. I think if I found something that really had no possible natural explanation, that's really what it would take to convince me there's something more out there than what I can see and what I might be able to experience. And I've gotten so many emails from people telling me, here's a miracle, check it out, I win the argument, you know? And it's so funny because the things they send me, if you did a simple Google search, you will find the explanation for why you see a certain image somewhere or why a certain medical thing happened the way it did. So I haven't experienced it firsthand yet, and I haven't seen anything that makes me question that. But I think that's the thing that I would need to happen, because I feel like I've heard just about every argument, apologetic, to convince me why I'm wrong. And nothing really does it for me. Nothing really convinces me that it is wrong or anything like that. So I say a miracle is what I would need to see.
The Hemant, I don't know if you're exactly aware of the main kind of focus of the Icon New Media Network and the majority involved in it, that, you know, including myself as an Orthodox priest. But I think it's important. I think you'll find this fascinating. Most of us, the vast majority of us, in fact, came out of some sort of evangelical Protestant background, mm-hmm. Similar to or akin to the churches that you were visiting. And we all had our different reasons, but I think among the many reasons would be, quite frankly, an absolute disillusionment with what we were experiencing in evangelical Protestantism. And for us, there was this centrality of who Jesus is, this clinging to him as the Savior, and yet looking at the rest of it going, this is BS, you know, something's mm-hmm. wrong. Mm-hmm. And so we went on a search. Now, you know, we came to a different place. We came to the historic Christian church. You went from your religion to a different place, but I think that we're all on journeys. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to understand that we're on journeys. We're on journeys. We're really looking for deep issues. We're looking for transcendent issues. And we're not interested in games anymore. And so, you know, I really would encourage you as soon as you can to check out an Orthodox church, because it's such a totally different. I mean, just talking to you about it over Skype is a disservice, and I apologize because there's no way I can communicate how different it is. But I can communicate that many of us were at the end of our ropes. We were sick and tired of what we were experiencing. We saw the BS. We saw the hypocrisy. We saw the heresy, quite honestly, from a historic Christian point of view. And, you know, we've found the Orthodox faith, and it's been a really cool experience for us. But we are on that journey in a similar way that people like yourself are.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you came to one conclusion, we came to another.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that for most of us, this is the conclusion. In other words, if I woke up one morning and started having a serious crisis of faith, I don't think I would turn to religious circles anymore. I think I'm done. I've had enough of religiosity and games. I don't want that anymore. I'm looking for something deeper. And it sounds to me like you're the same kind of person. You're exploring it on a different path, you know, through atheism, but you're still looking for something deeper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm open to the possibility that there could be, but I haven't found any real reason to divert from what I believe right now.
Well, that's obvious. It's obvious by the way that you talk. I mean, your language betrays the fact that you're still open to.
But I think most atheists I know would say the exact same thing. I don't know very many atheists that are saying, you know, quote, there is no God. I think many of them would say, I don't believe in one, but hey, if you want to show me the reason to believe, I'll listen to it. And I think I'm saying the same thing there.
You are. And really, I this may sound weird coming from an Orthodox priest, but I think your position is more intellectually honest than what you got in a lot of those evangelical churches, to be honest.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that. And, you know, even I was when I read The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, even, you know, there's a section there where he kind of puts out a spectrum of, you know, do you have no belief in God, or there is no God is at one end, and there is absolutely a God at the other end. And the question was, where does he put himself on the spectrum? He didn't even go so far as to say there is no God. If that's a 7, I think he put himself as a 6, where he is, I think the title of that chapter is Why There Is Almost Certainly No God. But even if he's not going so far as to leave it totally out of the picture, it's just that, you know, his point is that there's no reason to believe in it. But again, that possibility is there. No one's denying that.
Sure. I'll tell you, I had an experience, I've been sick, as you can hear, and I've watched a couple movies in the last few days, and I would recommend this, if you have the time, to really gain a very radically different perspective on what's out there in Christendom in America. First of all, I don't know if you've seen Jesus Camp.
I've seen Jesus Camp.
Okay.
Good movie.
A frightening movie,
definitely.
Very frightening movie. I think it exposes, without being mean-spirited, but it certainly exposes what evangelical Christianity is really all about. If you get the opportunity to rent a movie called Ostrov, which is a Russian movie, it won many, many awards in Russia. Came out, last year. O-S-T-R-O-V in English.
Okay.
Ostrov, it means the island. And
on the cover of the movie, it says it's spelled Octpob, O-C-T-P-O-B.
Those are the Slavonic letters. So,
yeah.
The movie though is set in a remote area of Russia, and it's about a man who, well, a man of deep faith, and yet a very strange man from one perspective. But look at the two movies, and then, without coming to a transcendent conclusion, but ask yourself the following, which is probably closer to the reality of Christianity?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be quite an experience for you. This is a brilliant movie. Even not religiously speaking, it's brilliantly filmed. It's beautiful to watch.
Okay.
It's beautiful. Beautiful. Ostro.
Cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah, and I'm glad you've seen Jesus Camp. I have to admit, I couldn't watch every minute of it. I literally had to keep – no, I really – it was like watching – you know, when you're driving down the freeway and there's a bad accident, you know? You want to watch, but you don't want to watch.
Yeah.
And that's what Jesus Camp is. It's a bad accident.
It just confirmed a lot of the stereotypes people already have, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the farther I think that people can remove themselves from that expression of Christianity, I think the closer they're going to be to the truth. I mean, I'm biased. I'm an Orthodox priest, but I think you're closer to the truth of who God is than those people are. And yet you're going under the name atheist, but I think that you're closer.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for coming on with us.
Sure. Thank you.
It's been a special edition of The Man in Black, but not Johnny Cash, with Father Andrew Welzig and Hemet Mehmet. Oh, goodness, I cannot say your name. I'm so sorry. And his book is I Sold My Soul on eBay, Viewing Faith Through an Atheist Eyes. And I would encourage everyone to check it out. So thank you guys very much.
Cool. Thank you.
Hey, God bless you, Hemet. Good talking to you, man.
Thank you for listening to The Man in Black, but Not Johnny Cash, with Father Andrew Welzig. If you have a comment or a question you would like to ask Father Andrew, please leave it on our channel at iconnewmedianetwork.com. The Man in Black, but Not Johnny Cash, is brought to you by the Orthodox Speakers Bureau. Need an Orthodox speaker for your next retreat or church event? Please visit them at orthodoxspeakers.com. And by ExistDesigns.com. If it's not online, it doesn't exist. Father Andrew Welzig is the pastor of St. John the Theologian in San Juan Capistrano, California. His website can be found at theologian.org. Steve McMeans is from the Orthodox Speakers Bureau. He can be found at orthodoxspeakers.com. And Jacob Lee is of Exist Designs. Exist Designs, if it's not online, it doesn't exist. ExistDesigns.com.